This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, radio listeners. This is your host, Howard Baum, doing my weekly reading of interesting articles from the March and April issue of Wired Magazine. The one I'm continuing with, as I started last week, it has the title, Love, Dementia, and Robots. When my parents got sick, I turned to a new generation of roboticists and their glowing, talking, warm-hearted creations. So I'll continue from where I stopped last week. The robot's torso and limbs are chubby and white. It seems to be naked except for blue briefs below its pot belly, although it does not have nipples. It is only 2 feet tall. Its face, a rectangular screen, blinks on. Two black ovals and a manga smile appear. Hello, I am QT, your robot friend, it says. It says this to everyone because that's its job. QT raises both arms in a touchdown gesture. The motors whir. They sound expensive. It might look and sound sort of familiar if you know anything about humanoid social robots. Contraptions built to respond to us in ways we recognize. You may also remember their long history of market failures. R.I.P. Curry, K.U.R.I., Cosmo, Asimo, Jibo, Pepper, and the rest of their expensive, over-promising metal kin. QT is not like them. It's not a consumer product. It's a research device equipped with microphones, a 3D camera, face recognition, and data recording capabilities built by a Luxembourgian company for scientists like Sabanovic to deploy in studies. She's using QT to explore Ikigai, I is spelled I-K-I-G-A-I, a Japanese word that roughly translates to a reason for living or sense of meaning in life, but also includes a feeling of social purpose and everyday joy. Doing a favor for a neighbor can create Ikigai, as can a hard week's of work. Even reflecting on life achievements can bring it on. Her team, funded by Toyota Research Institute, is tinkering with QT to see what kind of robot socializing, reminiscing, maybe, or planning activities, or perhaps just a certain line of conversation, might give someone a burst of that good feeling. To see QT in action, I drive Sabanovic and graduate student Long Jing Hsu over to Jill's house, a small memory care home in Bloomington, less than 2 miles from the university. Sabanovic and her teams of students and collaborators have worked alongside residents here for years. It's now September, and all summer, Hsu has visited every week, leading workshops, testing small adjustments to QT's demeanor and functionality, collecting data on how people react to the robot, whether they smile, mirror its gestures, volunteer parts of their life story, or get bored and annoyed. Making decisions about how and what the robot should do is not up to the researchers, said Sabanovic. It's up to this deliberative, participatory process in engaging more people in the conversation. One challenge is that dementia is never the same for any two people. There are different varieties, such as Alzheimer's, frontotemporal dementia, and Lewy, L-E-W-Y, body disease, and they are dynamic, changing with time. Some people have no problem with memory, but struggle with words. Others make strange decisions. Many say their perception of time changes, or their senses become more acute. Some people are angrier, some calmer, and others lose all filters and say whatever they think. Parentheses, I'm looking at you, Mom. End parentheses. In my experience, dementia doesn't erode individuality. It sharpens and twists it. As the disease advances, it can steal the ability to drive a car, operate a microwave, change clothes. It also layers on new habits and quirks. My mother, for instance, has always loved natural history. With dementia, she now can become completely absorbed in a leaf, a flower, or a pattern of light and shadow in the trees. A good, useful, helpful robot must adapt to each person at each phase. Today, Sue will demo a storytelling game between a person and machine. Eventually, QT will retain enough information to make the game personalized for each participant. For now, the point is to test QT's evolving conversational skills to see what behaviors and responses people will accept from a robot and which come across as confusing or rude. I'm excited to see how this plays out. I'm expecting spicy reactions. People with dementia can be a tough audience, with little tolerance for encounters that are annoying or hard to understand. After I park the car, Sabanovic and I enter a large common room with cathedral ceilings and high windows, bright with sunlight. As we chat with the director, Hsu crosses at the back, a small figure pushing a white robot on a cart past the wing-back chairs and overstuffed love seats to a small side conference room. It's a spectacle, but the residents who are hanging out this afternoon take little note. To them, robots are old news. We follow her into the side room and pull chairs into a semicircle around the robot on its table. Sabanovic will mostly just watch today as Hsu troubleshoots the tech and leads the session. Soon, Mary Ellen, an energetic woman in a red IU ball cap, walks in and takes a seat across from the robot. Mary Ellen has enjoyed talking to QT in the past, but she's having an off day. She's nervous. "I'm in early Alzheimer's, so sometimes I get things wrong," she apologizes. The robot asks her to select an image from a tablet and make up a story. Mary Ellen gamely plays along, spinning a tale. A woman, maybe a student, walks alone in the autumn woods. "Interesting," says QT. "Have you experienced something like this before?" "I have," Mary Ellen says. "We have beautiful trees around Bloomington." The robot stays silent, a smile plastered across its screen. QT has terrible timing, pausing too long when it should speak, interrupting when it should listen. We all share an apologetic laugh over the machine's bad manners. Mary Ellen is patient, speaking to QT as if it were a dim-witted child. She understands that the robot is not trying to be a jerk. Today's robot-human chat is objectively dull, but it also feels like a breath of fresh air. Everyone in this room takes Mary Ellen seriously. Instead of dismissing her pauses and uncertainty as symptoms, the scientists pay careful attention to what she says and does. Next enters Phil, a man with a tidy brush mustache, neatly dressed in chinos and a short-sleeve button-down printed shirt with vintage cars. After taking a seat across from the robot, he chimes in with QT to sing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." He faces the machine, but he's playing to us, mugging and rolling his eyes. Song over, he first teases Hsu, then another resident, then pretty much every woman in the room. In other circumstances, he would be patronized or diverted. Someone would attempt to distract him. Instead, we join him in being silly, joking about the situation and the robot. QT pipes up with another round of awkward conversation. Parentheses, "I love the song, do you?" End parentheses. And Phil replies with a combination of graciousness and sass. Parentheses, "You sing very well. Did you have that recorded, maybe?" End parentheses. Hsu asks Phil how he felt talking to the machine. He says, like a fool, talking to nothing, he says. I know it's not a real person. Theatrically, he turns to the robot. You're not real, are you? He winks and laughs uproariously. He likes the robot? He doesn't? It'll be the team's job to figure out these enigmatic yet relatable reactions. The three of us, plus robot, pack up and head back to Sabanovic's R House lab at the university. In the big conference room there, her team will converge students of informatics, data science, computer vision, and psychology. They'll pick apart Mary Ellen's kindness and hesitations and Phil's glee and annoyance, looking for their next task, the next skill that QT needs to learn. I drive around for a while thinking. The demonstration session was playful and lighthearted, but the room also had an unfamiliar energy that I hadn't felt before in the context of dementia. Activities for people with dementia are usually perfused with nostalgia, turning away from the difficult present to relive what remains of the past. But today was all about the future. We were imagining, playing at new kinds of relationships, trying to brainstorm applications and uses that are still hard to picture. It felt creative. More precisely, it felt alive. The R House Lab at Bloomington seems to be an ordinary conference room. White walls, large wood conference table and desks, chairs and monitors ringing the walls. But it is littered with the artifacts of Selma Sabanovic's research career, a menagerie of robots and robot parts. Perched on a windowsill are two butter-yellow keep-on units, an early invention that's little more than two spheres with eyes and a button nose. A fluffy white seal named Perro recharges on a filing cabinet, its power supply a pink pacifier plugged in where its mouth should be. In the back of the room lurk two of Honda's 2018 Haru, something like a desk lamp crossed with a crab. Three more QTs, parentheses 2017, doze on tables. It's like an unnatural history museum, and Sabanovic is the resident David Attenborough. Sabanovic, 46 years old, is tall and slender with a cloud of dark hair and an aura of sly humor that suits this strange place. Now she sits at the back of the room as her team hashes out ways to solve QT's social problems. At one point, the students get stuck on QT's habit of interrupting. Maybe that's okay, Sabanovic proposes. We can play off the fact that it will be, inevitably, to some degree, stupid, she suggests. What the researchers need to figure out is where stupidity is harmful. She may be in her element, but the defunct and sleeping robots give the room a weird energy, as if it were full of ghosts. This, I learn, is the superpower of social robots, not strength, not speed or precision, but vibes. They grab hold of our psyche. They get under our skin. Even though we know better, we respond to them as if they were alive. The tech critic and author Sherry Turkle calls it pushing people's Darwinian buttons. Unlike most other gadgets, robots get our social instincts tingling. Of course, explains Sabanovic, what distinguishes robots is that they have a body, she adds. They can move, show they're paying attention, trigger us. Children learn more from a robot than a screen. Adults trust robots more readily than computers. Dogs obey their commands. Sabanovic is fascinated by these reactions, which makes sense, because she has lived her life in the company of robots. Her parents were both engineers, and her father worked on industrial robots. Back in those years, the only social robots were in fiction. Her father's contraptions were serious machines for heavy industry. When she was 9 in 1987, the family spent a summer in Yokohama. An only child, she would often tag along to work and curl up in the lab with a book. In Japan, she noticed, fictional robots were friendly and helpful, more Astro Boy than Terminator. In college in the mid to late 90s, she puzzled over those differences and wondered why some cultures assumed future robots would be sweet and cute, while others imagined them as villains or thugs. By then, she was also dropping in at conferences with her parents, where she heard about real social robots, machines designed to interact with humans on our terms. This seemed like a strange idea. The industrial robots she knew so well were unattractive and untouchable, doing dangerous tasks on assembly lines. "It was super intriguing to me. How do they think this is going to work?" she says. She wanted to understand these new relationships forming between people and machines. In graduate school, she visited and observed the people who were developing the field of social robotics. In 2005, she spent time with the pioneering roboticist Takanori Shibata at Japan's National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology and his robot seal pup, Pero. Handcrafted, the little critter responded to speech and touch by bleating. It was programmed with actual seal pup cries, closing its eyes and flipping its tail and flippers. It was one of very few robots at the time that could be used outside the lab without expert assistance. Even at this early stage, elderly people were a target audience. The researchers took the machine to care homes, and Sabanovic was startled to see the effect. People would suddenly light up, start talking to it, tell you stories about their lives, she says. Shibata's studies, then and later, showed that the cuddly seal improved quality of life. It got people to interact more, reduced stress, and eased depression. So Sabanovic joined the emerging field of human-robot interaction. Her experiments since have explored how we project our techno-scientific imaginaries, our cultural baggage, fears, and fantasies, onto these hunks of metal and plastic. Sort of like if Isaac Asimov became an experimental psychologist. In one early study, she brought Pero into a nursing home to study how the device turned wallflowers into butterflies. Most residents would ignore the seal pup until other people showed up. Then it would become an icebreaker or a social lure. They would gather to touch it. They'd comment on its sound and movements, laughing. The robot, she saw, seemed to open a door to other people. Starting in the 2010s, with new machines like Haru and the Android Nao, NAO, which had more feelings and data collecting capacity, she has explored ways to bring more kinds of people into the creative process. Since then, Sabanovic has co-written a textbook on human-robot interactions and examined dynamics among children, robots, and groups of people. During my visit, Sabanovic's group was preparing to bring QT out to meet the public for the first time at the annual conference of the Dementia Action Alliance in Indianapolis. Unlike most meetings about brain diseases, this one has no sessions about new drugs and no pharma-funded cocktail hours. Also, unlike other conferences, it includes a lot of people who have dementia. Its purpose is to foster community and share knowledge, but as I would learn, it's also a coalition of people who are fed up with shame and stigma and are starting to insist on something better. I was about to meet people who not only could bear the diagnosis with hope, but embrace it. Indianapolis Crown Plaza Hotel was built as a Gilded Age train station, and the conference exhibition hall is a former waiting area. Its tiled hallways now echoing with the chatter of people filling the room. Most people drift by without pausing to inspect the robots perched on the table in front of Wesley Koo, a postdoctoral researcher in computer vision who is in charge of the machines today. Then Diana Pagan makes a beeline for Perro, the little white seal. She strokes it as it flips its tail and slowly blinks its huge black eyes. She's thoroughly charmed. "It's relatable," she says. "It's more real to me. Whereas that thing, gesturing at QT, is a machine." Her middle-aged son, John Richard Pagan, is curious about QT, but he's prone to hallucinations, he says, and would not want a talking robot in his home. A voice coming out of the box would be disturbing, he says. John Richard has Lewy body dementia, which can cause confusion and problems with attention. He is also a self-proclaimed techie and a bit of an early adopter. Back in the day, he had a Commodore 64 computer, an early mass-produced home computer. Now he's part of a technology working group organized by the Dementia Action Alliance. He seems to be a robot kind of guy on paper, but in general, robots fail his tests. "Most inventors don't get it," he says. "Anything for people with dementia has to be intuitive. You can't assume someone's around to explain how to use it. It has to be affordable because many people with dementia are on fixed incomes, and it would need to be flexible and personalizable." John Richard would like a machine that can recognize when he is having a bad day. Maybe it analyzes his speech patterns and tells him to rest, or perhaps it plays music. Maybe it talks to him softly when it hears him scream in his sleep from dementia-induced night terrors and tells him he's okay, that he's not alone. "Wherever I'm at, it hears me and acknowledges me," he says. "It works with my flow." Over the next few days of the conference, people share stories of what dementia is like, swap tips to make life easier, and talk about the hardships and good times. It feels like a family get-together. Instead of black holes, these narratives are bittersweet mixtures of loss and discovery. One speaker says he can't balance his checkbook anymore, although he once was an accountant. But he fell in love with photography, and his creative life is flourishing. During a presentation, Sabanovic asks the audience how a home robot might make their lives better. She listens, stroking Perro, and the conversation inevitably turns toward the ick factor. "A robot animal that talks is dehumanizing," says one woman with dementia. "I see the opposite," says another, elaborating. "If it makes someone happy, why should others judge?" Hearing people with dementia debate these ethics themselves, it is obvious that they should have led this conversation all along. The discussion should be one of thousands on who is entitled or not only life, but also self-fulfillment and self-definition. The roboticists I talked to all point to an influential paper by Amanda Lazar, a professor of human-computer interaction at the University of Maryland. Lazar described in 2017 how the field of human-computer interaction might learn from new thinking about dementia and the mind. Going way back to René Descartes, human cognition has conventionally been defined around the capacity to reason, to speak, to remember. Those definitions exclude many people with dementia, and Lazar argued they also limit our imagination about what computers and robots can be. In more recent decades, cognitive scientists have explored and considered human capacities like mind-body connections, sensory experiences, and emotions, which can be intact or even heightened in dementia. Perhaps, Lazar suggests, our vision of tech could expand in parallel, away from purely cognitive prosthetics and towards a more holistic appreciation of mental function. Her formulation is aimed at other scholars, but it ricochets around my brain. My parents don't remember. They live vividly in the moment, cracking jokes, noticing tiny details of my clothing or hair, constantly surprising me with their strong opinions. Both are newly fascinated by the constant traffic in their California suburb. "Look at all the cars," my mother says to me, or my father says to my mother in wonder mixed with horror. They teach me that imagination and creativity persists in the human brain long after memory and logic breaks down. "It's like a wool bathing suit," said my dad out of the blue at dinner one night, pointing to his face. Eventually, I realized that he was telling me his beard was getting itchy and needed trimming. They would have no idea how to deal with QT and its cheerful questions and answers. This Igikai project is not designed for people whose language is starting to fracture. But other inventors have people like them in mind, Lazar told me over Zoom. In the Netherlands, in Belgium, and in the UK, a weirder wave of robot development is venturing into the uncharted world of advanced dementia, finding untapped possibilities for play and delight, creating robots for the soul. A pair of round white blobs sit side by side, each the size and shape of a pumpkin. Every 10 minutes or so, the orbs croak like frogs or chirp like crickets and sparkle with light. They want your attention. Pick one up, and depending on whether you stroke it, tap it, or shake it, it will respond with noise and light. If the orbs are set to spring mode and you stroke one, it will sing like a bird and blush from white to pink. If you ignore the second blob, it will act jealous, flushing red. If your friend then picks up orb number two, they will mimic each other's light and sound, encouraging you to play together. The blobs are called Sam, and together they form a social robot boiled down to its essence, an invitation to connect. Sam is one of the otherworldly creations emerging from the Dementia and Technology Expertise Center at the Eindhoven University of Technology in the Netherlands. Rens Brinkert and his colleagues don't call this or the other things they make a robot. They call it warm technology. "We want to contribute to the warmth between people," he says, "and to create gadgets that a wider range of people would enjoy using." Well, folks, that wraps up this reading of the article in this issue of Wired Magazine of March and April. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. I will continue reading from it next week. This is your host, Howard Baum, wishing you a great day.